cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Messer is off. Ahead on the program, we'll examine the state of the U.S. trucking business with carriers in the midst of the holiday deluge. We'll talk restaurants with the CEO of OpenTable, and we'll hear from a newly minted Bloomberg 50 honoree who's rewriting the labor story at Starbucks. All of that to come. We begin, though, with a story that everyone keeps talking about. And no, we are not talking about the Fed's latest interest rate hike, but FTX. Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Chafkin has a story online and on the terminal that focuses on the relationship between Sam Bankman-Fried and Binance's Changpeng Zhao, better known as CZ. CZ, as you may recall, helped last month to blow the whistle on his longtime rival's failures. Carol and I asked Max about the implications of that with Bankman-Fried, who's now in custody in the Bahamas. Congress continues to probe what happened.
I think it's pretty clear, you know, he's got some tough legal sledding ahead. It's who else gets roped into this. So there are other figures connected, obviously, to FTX. Carolyn Ellison, of course.
Former girlfriend of Samuel Bankman.
Yeah, ex-girlfriend, CEO of Alameda. And also kind of the person that Sam Bankman-Fried was sort of, it kind of felt like was trying to pin this all on, perhaps unfairly.
Talk about a messy breakup. No, just kidding.
Yeah. And then you have the other crypto exchanges. And, you know, we've seen this play out before over the last few months where we have one exchange go down, one major player in crypto go down, and it's starting to suck everybody else down. People have been talking about, you know, this sort of unfolding credit crisis. And I think it remains to be seen, you know, kind of who else does Sam Bankman-Fried, bring down with him. And I think it's very possible because, as we've seen in sort of the details of this case, these guys were all pretty tightly, you know, enmeshed. And one of the interesting things that in the testimony that Sam Bankman-Fried, which, you know, we and others have been talking about, you know, he's got these text messages from other CEOs of exchanges. The title of this text message group is Exchange Coordination. It's all very weird, and it makes you wonder whether anybody else is potentially vulnerable either to like legal issues or potentially just asset prices falling and then hurting other companies.
Right, makes me wonder like how systemic all of this is and who else comes down beyond the FTX kind of universe. At the same time, it also makes me wonder about collusion, and I'm not maybe using it in a legal way, and also kind of, you know, harken back to like robber barons where, you know, anything could happen and people would get rid of their other competitors or smaller competitors because they wanted to own the marketplace. And I feel like that's where potentially CZ comes in.
Yeah, and you look at like why was Gary Gensler, why were people in the US resistant to this to these companies? And one reason was potential manipulation. You have these very small number of players, lightly chained like traded currencies, and they're going around trying to pull in money from normal people, which of course raises questions. You bring up Zhao, CZ. So Changpeng Zhao CEO of Binance, which is the other major exchange, basically Sam Bankman-Fried's main competitor. And over the years, these two had a serious rivalry where it was kind of happening, as I write in the column today, this is all kind of happening behind the scenes. But they were both, and in Binance's case, are both operating in regulatory gray areas. So as we know, Sam Bankman-Fried, based in the Bahamas, was operating this kind of quote-unquote offshore exchange. Binance, kind of same situation, operating no one really knows where. That's the main difference. There, as far as we're concerned, we don't know where Binance's headquarters is, but it's the same thing where they're trading these altcoins, S coins they're sometimes called, as well as crypto derivatives. Much of that is not allowed in the U.S. And as a result, they're in this kind of regulatory gray area, and that has left them kind of vulnerable to, you know, potential SEC sanction, CFTC, potentially even criminal investigation. What we saw behind the scenes is that Zhao and Sam Bankman-Fried were kind of vying to find a way to sort of legalize their business, to take this business from the gray area and bring it into the light. And I think that's part of what led to the conflict, and maybe even part of what led to the run on withdrawals that ultimately exposed the FTX, the alleged fraud at FTX.
Well, go back to this idea of FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, because a big portion of your column today is about that. And I don't know if you've, you know, found yourself at the center of this at all, Max, but if you talk about crypto online and you express any skepticism about it, you are accused of spreading FUD, as you write in
right.
your column. So where does FUD come into this conflict?
So everybody who's anybody in crypto has like thrown around the suggestion of FUD. Changpeng Zhao has a huge Twitter following. He's got like 8 million or 7 million followers. I'm not exactly sure which. But he's constantly, anytime anyone writes anything negative, you know, he's calling FUD. We saw about a month ago, it was kind of his tweet in response to these CoinDesk reports. The CoinDesk reports were about, you know, this shaky balance sheet. Sam Bankman-Fried and his colleagues are denying it. Zhao comes in and says, hey, this looks really concerning. We're going to sell our, you know, FTX tokens called FTT. And that sets off this run. And in, you know, in some sense, right, Zhao is spreading what a crypto person would call FUD. In another sense, he's acting as a whistleblower. He's exposing a actual flaw. Now, and so I think it's important, you know, we got to make that distinction. But since then, Zhao has kind of seemed to do the same thing to a couple of other exchanges, which is interesting and perhaps telling. You know, he a couple weeks ago, he sort of went after Coinbase, suggesting that Coinbase was shaky. Coinbase, of course, is based in the U.S., has audited financial statements. It's a serious charge. He deleted the tweet. Same thing with Kraken, another reputable exchange. And he also deleted that tweet. And I think what's going on is you have the FTX collapse, and that's creating a sense of panic in the market, potential legal vulnerability.
Right.
It's also shrinking the market, and it's creating an opportunity for somebody like Binance or Coinbase or Kraken or any of these people to consolidate and to get customers. In that sense, an opportunity, but it's also shrinking the market dramatically.
Right.
So you kind of have a sense the lights just came on and there aren't enough chairs. They're all trying to find a chair.
That was Bloomberg Business Week columnist Max Chafkin. We'll continue to monitor all of the latest developments with FTX and bring you the news as it breaks. Now we want to also bring your attention to a great piece from Business Week national correspondent Josh Green. Writing for Bloomberg Opinion this week, Josh says that Elon Musk is ruining former President Donald Trump's latest presidential bid. Bloomberg News senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld and I spoke with Josh about the irony of Musk inviting the former president back to Twitter, which would, of course, detract from Trump's current social media home, Truth Social.
The whole rationale for having an alternative right-wing social media platform was to get kind of people to go over there and be able to turn that into a business that makes a lot of money. And Trump has a chunk of that. The minute everybody starts gravitating back to Twitter, and certainly if the biggest power user of them all and Donald Trump were to go back, it would really obviate any sort of a need for a right-wing social platform. So I think that's about the only thing that's kept him from going back. But in his absence, a new Twitter overlord has emerged, and that is Elon Musk. And as I say in the column, he's essentially overshadowing and eclipsing Donald Trump, whose political superpower always has been to be able to dominate the political conversation largely through the use of Twitter.
So I'm hearing you talk, I'm reading your column, and it brings me to a natural question, which is, how does this end? Are we going to be watching Musk's campaign in however many years?
I don't think that Elon Musk has any real interest in politics besides just kind of weighing in with his takes, which he seems to be doing about every 30 minutes on Twitter, from what I can tell. And I would never hazard a guess to predict, you know, how Trump's campaign is going to go. But I will say this, you know, what first elevated Trump, in national politics was his ability to draw all the attention to himself, to just be this constant churning story that you couldn't look away from, that eclipsed everybody else and that drove the news cycle on Twitter, on cable media, on newspaper headlines. And the one thing that Trump has really lost since January 6th, since he was deplatformed, was his ability to do that. He just doesn't have the outlet he once did. And as we can see, I mean, he launched his presidential campaign 3 weeks ago, and it's pretty much been crickets ever since then. The only real topic of conversation was his dining with white nationalists. And that's sort of not the kind of press that you want when you're trying to launch a White House bid. But what has replaced that, the guy who is driving the news cycle all day and all night, you know, is now Elon Musk. And if that lane is occupied by Musk, it's going to make it awfully difficult for Trump to become what he once was.
Well, what if that lane is occupied by Elon Musk, and then Elon Musk then goes and decides to get behind someone like Ron DeSantis, for example?
Well, I think it's problematic for Trump, and you can see this in all sorts of ways. I mean, in the column, you know, I looked at Twitter followers. Musk has 50 million more. I looked at Google search mentions. Elon Musk is easily eclipsing Donald Trump. But I think what's even more important from a political standpoint is that if you go to a place like Breitbart News, the hard right news site to help launch Donald Trump, they now have a vertical on Elon Musk, and they're writing about his Twitter stuff every day. And Trump is almost an afterthought. You know, he's sort of buried at the bottom of the page.
That was Business Week national correspondent Josh Green with Katie Greifeld and me. Check out Josh's full piece online or on the terminal by typing OPIN Go. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, the president of shipping payments platform TriumphPay breaks down the massive volume of packages on the move this holiday season. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Americans shipped more than 50 million packages last holiday season with the U.S. Postal Service. And with package volumes continuing to increase, thanks in large part to the rise of online shopping, the agency is preparing for an even higher volume of parcels this year. The trucking industry helps move many of those around the country. But driver shortages are creating doubts that everything can get to its intended destination and on time. Melissa Foreman is the president at TriumphPay. This is a payment platform, and what it does is it connects brokers, shippers, and carriers. It's a division of TBK Bank, member of the FDIC, and part of the publicly traded Triumph Financial. It's got about a $1.3 billion market cap. We asked Melissa for her assessment.
We're uniquely positioned, given where we sit within the transaction flow of payments, to really have a good understanding of what drivers and carriers are experiencing in the industry. And so TriumphPay makes about $24 billion annualized payments to carriers per year. And that's the most of anybody in the industry. And so in doing that, it gives us that unique view. And we recently did a survey of our drivers that we're paying. And what's happening right now is it's truly unprecedented. You know, when you look at the full truckload market, consumer spending is shifting from products to services. And so what does that mean on the transportation industry? It means that the trucks, you know, aren't getting full. The inventories are high in all of the retail chains that are out there. And so they're just not restocking all of that. When we talked to our drivers out there, they said, you know, 80% of them indicated that their revenues in 22 were down from 21. And while 22 started strong in the freight market, we've seen, you know, on the spot side of that, in the last, you know, two quarters, a significant cliff where it's fallen off. And, you know, 55% of those guys out there are saying, guys and gals, that spot rates are their number one concern. And you have to ask yourself why. Why does that matter? You know, spot rates aren't lower than they were a few years ago. They still would seem healthy in comparison to previous years. But what's changed over the pandemic and COVID and the supply chain issues that we've had over the last couple of years is that the, you know, inflation has increased, the cost of their equipment, fuel prices are at record highs for diesel. And so when you compound that with the rising interest rates, their cost to operate has skyrocketed. And so what would have been a healthy level a couple years ago is now in many cases where carriers are taking on freight where they're hauling that load at a loss. What's wow. even more pressing about that is that they have to do that in front all the expenses to be able to pay for the fuel, pay for the drivers, you know, settlements, pay for the equipment insurance. And they're doing that up front, but yet they have to wait 30 to 60 days to get paid. And so it just further compresses them and puts them in a position where they're just being squeezed out of the market. It's really hard for them to operate right now.
Melissa, help me understand what goes on in the trucking market. I know people who've owned their own cabs, right? And they, I guess, do their own thing. But is it largely kind of like individual owners of trucks, or is it a lot of larger companies that have their own trucker base? Yeah, if you could explain some of the dynamics of the industry.
Sure, Carol, that's a great question. And if you look at the truckload over the road market for hire, about 85% to 90% of trucking companies are five trucks or less. So they are small businesses living the American dream, trying to build, you know, their businesses, and yet they have all this upfront expense and these pressures that are squeezing out their margins.
Well, is it any different though from anyone else who either has to get in a car to head to work or has to buy clothes to go to work? Like, tell me, is it not just kind of the same that everybody's facing right now? And it's companies are trying to figure out the balance between raising wages, right, to meet what's going on with the inflation pressures. And we talk a lot about wage inflation. Wages have gone up a lot. But, you know, what's the balance? Because if you raise the costs, the wages too much and everything gets too expensive, you do wonder if people are going to slow down on demand for those in the trucking industry.
It is quite similar. However, it trails what consumers do a little bit longer. And so because of the cost to acquire that equipment, you have these assets and, you know, these carriers are fighting hard to keep them on the road and to keep them profitable. You can't just say one day, I'm going to take a different job where I make more money. You've got an expense that you have to handle and either offload or take a loss. And so they are working as hard as they can to be able to stay in the business, stay on the road, keep their trucks moving, but doing so in a profitable way, because you can only take a loss for so long before you either get bought, right? You sell off your company, or you've lost everything that you've built. And so they tend to stay in a little bit longer, and those that make it through survive, because we know that transportation is cyclical. And what happens is, you know, you have this pressure, and this happens, you know, every few years where you start seeing, you know, capacity start to come out of the market, which will rebalance. But again, it's lagging. And so to get that capacity back in the market is also lagging. And so as, you know, we look forward to probably end of 23 or even beyond, when things start to stabilize a little bit and consumer spending shifts back to products, we've got to make sure that those carriers are there and that the drivers are there and able to haul that freight for us, or we'll be in a similar situation that we ran into at the beginning of COVID, where there just was no capacity and back in a significant driver shortage situation.
For a decade, we've been hearing about automation in the context of driverless trucks.
Yeah, and good question.
You're laughing. Right. You're laughing. And it's interesting. I mean, I remember being at a dinner with a Silicon Valley friend who was early at one of the Silicon Valley firms. And he said, we are going to see a revolution in trucking. And this was more than 5 years ago because of driverless trucks. We haven't seen them yet. Are we going to see them on a large scale anytime soon?
There is certainly some efficiencies you can gain, and there are some applications for it. But, you know, if we haven't mastered how to get a car to be driverless on the road, it's really hard to do that with a long haul truck. Right.
Hey, Melissa, what do truckers get paid?
Oh, it depends. So right now, if you look at spot rates, it's around $1.86 per mile. And that is, you know, that's all in, or $2 a mile. That's all in. They have to pay for their truck, their fuel. Most trucks are running around, you know, 5 to 8, maybe 9 if they're brand new miles per gallon. And so they're not the most efficient vehicles out there. So it's their margins are, you know, anywhere from, you know, 8 to 12, maybe 15% on the high end in a good market. And that's without the higher inflation and costs of their equipment and their financing to get that equipment that has gone up recently.
What are the rules in place to prevent drivers from driving long hours so they don't get too tired if this incentive system is in place that actually, you know, pays people per mile?
Yeah, absolutely. So FMCSA has hours of service regulations that are in place. All drivers, certainly those that cross border and run outside of a 100-mile radius, adhere to standards. And they have electronic logs that keep track of every minute of their day. So they have to log when they're resting, they have to log when they're sleeping, they have to log when they're on duty, off duty, not driving. Every part of their day is tracked. And the formulas will tell them how much they can drive today. And so when you think about, you know, the driver shortage, a big part of that came from, you know, implementing the electronic logging of those, which held drivers accountable to not being able to go over their hours.
That was Melissa Foreman. She's the president at Triumph Pay. Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, we go from the shipping economy to the local economy for an in-depth conversation with the mayor of Tulsa, Oklahoma, G.T. Bynum.
The big concern is inflation and the challenges that presents with keeping up with costs as a city government, where we have to have a balanced budget every year and providing the level of service that people expect when the cost of doing everything, whether that's fixing a street or hiring a police officer, is dramatically more expensive than it was just 2 years ago.
This is Bloomberg.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
From time to time, we like to check in with mayors from some of America's great cities. It really helps us get a feel for life on the ground and gain insight into growth, labor markets, investment, innovation, and more. Today, we're focusing on Tulsa, Oklahoma. Back in the fall, Bloomberg News reported that a consortium, including Devon Energy, Williams Companies, and more, is partnering with a Tulsa nonprofit founded by the George Kaiser Family Foundation. The hope here is to bring as many as 2,000 energy tech jobs to Oklahoma over the next 5 to 10 years. Carol and I recently had the opportunity to welcome Tulsa Mayor G.T. Bynum into our studios. And despite a rather gloomy economic outlook for the U.S. heading into 2023, Mayor Bynum is not buying in.
Everything in Tulsa right now is very strong. I mean, we're seeing probably the greatest moment of investment in the history of the city is occurring right now, both across the public and private sectors. Our core industries in Tulsa, of course, are energy and aerospace, but we're also seeing a tremendous level of interest and investment around advanced mobility. That's something that we just secured. We were one of 21 cities out of 600 that applied that secured a Build Back Better regional challenge grant from U.S. Department of Commerce. And we're using that to build the advanced mobility industry in Tulsa that's expected to develop 30 to 40,000 new jobs over the next few years with a projected economic impact between $3.5 and $5 billion. So right now, I mean, the economy is very strong for us, I think. And as a mayor, the big concern is inflation and the challenges that presents with keeping up with costs as a city government, where we have to have a balanced budget every year and providing the level of service that people expect when the cost of doing everything, whether that's fixing a street or hiring a police officer, is dramatically more expensive than it was just 2 years ago.
We also want to mention that Mr. Mayor has participated in the Bloomberg Harvard City Leadership Initiative and also the Bloomberg Philanthropies City Data Alliance. Of course, these have been founded by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Mayor Bynum, what would you like your economy to be? Energy has been a blessing, mm-hmm. right? But it can be a curse in terms of overexposure. Where do you want your economy to be in, let's say, 5 years?
Well, I think the key for us is that we want our economy to be diversified and be one where it's creating equality of opportunity in our city. We have consolidated all of our economic development efforts in Tulsa behind that goal of using economic development to drive equality of opportunity in our city. We think that the advanced mobility industry presents a really great opportunity right now in the history of that industry.
So when you say advanced mobility, you mean specifically what and who?
For us, what I'm talking about there would be drones, electric vehicles, autonomous vehicles. The funding that we receive from U.S. Department of Commerce, we're using to build a 110-mile drone testing corridor through the Osage Nation that they are going to build. We're building an autonomous vehicle.
So they benefit.
Correct. The Osage Nation. Tulsa's at the intersection of three tribal nations, the Osage, Cherokee, and Muscogee Creek. We work with all three of them on our economic development efforts. But we think that that one is a big one. The other key one for us, Tulsa actually, we get no attention for this, but it's kind of by design. The University of Tulsa is probably the leading university in the nation when it comes to graduating cybersecurity graduates. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to go away. It's not a fad.
Right.
It is something that's growing. And so the great challenge for us is to have that intellectual capital at our university, and how do we translate that into new companies and job creation?
How do you get those students who graduate to stay in Tulsa and work for companies that are there?
Right. You know, educate them, but you want that younger generation to stick around.
Oh, no. I mean, that's the challenge is federal agencies historically have just vacuumed up all these graduates and they've gone all over the world rather than staying in Tulsa. You mentioned the George Kaiser.
So they're spies, is what you're
you
saying.
You said that, not me.
Okay. Go on.
You mentioned the George Kaiser Family Foundation. They're actually working with the University of Tulsa to lead an initiative that spurs the growth of companies by graduates coming out of the University of Tulsa's cybersecurity program, so that it has two arms. It has one where it's preparing graduates for public service, and then it has
for spying. You can say no
for
just
public
kidding.
Service, which Sorry. Might be a public service, and then an arm that's there for business growth and entrepreneurship.
What's the trickiest part of your job right now, in terms of as you look at the economy? There's a lot of uncertainty. Tim kicked it off the conversation about we're trying to figure out what next year holds for us, even in a downturn because of the energy pad and the energy crunch that we've seen. Does that give you guys a lot of room?
I mean, the trickiest part of my job right now is that there is so much growth that we don't want to get out too far over our skis where we find ourselves in a position. I started as a city councilor 2 months before the Great Recession began. And I saw what happens to a local government that builds in costs that all of a sudden you wake up one day and realize you can't cover anymore.
Right.
And you have to start looking at laying off police officers and firefighters, and no mayor and no city ever wants to be in that position. So how do you maximize the growth of our city and move with the opportunities we have before us right now, but to the point you're raising earlier about what those CEOs are saying, we don't know what's waiting for us in 2023 or 24. And the economy always comes down at some point. And so when will that be? And how are we being very secure and being prepared for that while trying to maximize growth?
We had Mayor Maddie Parker from Dallas-Fort Worth here.
Yeah,
Fort
she's
Worth
great.
Mayor.
Yeah,
yeah, she is great. Just a few weeks ago. I asked her this question too, because both of you are young, politically moderate Republicans. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if it's tough to be a moderate Republican when you see what's happening in the Republican Party on a national level. Like, how does that make your job more difficult?
Oh, I think it's tough to be a moderate anybody right now. I mean, I think that the greatest threat to our country right now is the political polarization that occurs. It's one of the reasons I'm so thankful that I work in local government, where Republicans and Democrats and independents still do work together to solve practical problems. I mean, you mentioned the Bloomberg City Data Alliance. That's one of the things I love about, as a mayor, being able to utilize data. It's a tool where you can bring people of different political philosophies together and solve problems that they don't have to be philosophical debates. They can be practical problems that you solve. How do we build a better street? How do we hire more police officers?
Does it make
a
difference?
Yes.
Because, you know, we're very
makes all the difference
number
in the world.
Data, you know, centric. And I feel like data tells our numbers or information tells a certain story or tells the truth. But does it resonate no matter what the political leanings might be of a party that you're talking to?
It 100% does. And I say this as somebody who worked as an aide in Congress for 6 years before I moved home and ran for the city council. All of our street projects are selected based on analytics. The numbers that we determine on how many police officers we need, that's based on analytics. Mm. We're trying to build out more and more utilizations of data into the work we do as a city so that we're taking that partisan polarization that you see so much at the federal level and boil it down into more practical problem solving that people can get around. And by the way, my mayoral administration, it's equally divided between Republicans, Democrats, and independents. Our city council is the same way. At the local level, you still see that collaboration that is non-existent at the federal level today.
We'd be remiss. We've only got about 30, 40 seconds. But the legacy of Black Wall Street, mm-hmm. How does that factor in?
Well, I mean, that's driving so much of what we do right now. I ran for mayor. I decided to run for mayor the day that I realized that there was an 11-year life expectancy gap between kids growing up in the predominantly African-American part of Tulsa and the rest of the city. As a dad of two kids, I wanted the kids growing up in that part of the city to have the same opportunities that my kids do. And so everything that we're doing as a city right now around economic development and city services is around creating that equality of opportunity so that Tulsa really can be a city where every kid has an equal opportunity for a great life, regardless of the part of town they're growing up in.
That was Tulsa, Oklahoma Mayor G.T. Bynum. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week, and coming up next, we're going to check in with one of the honorees from this year's Bloomberg 50, how Michelle Eisen went head-to-head with coffee giant Starbucks and helped galvanize a pro-labor movement among its hourly workers.
Billions of dollars are made off of the backs of the labor that is in the floor of these cafes every single day. And yet you've got workers who can't pay their rent and put groceries in their fridge. There's an imbalance there, and something needs to be done about it.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
This past week, Bloomberg Business Week released its sixth annual Bloomberg 50 list. It pays homage to those in business, politics, science, and technology, finance, and entertainment whose accomplishments over the past year deserve recognition. And while world leaders, celebrities, and top executives are included, you don't have to be a household name to make the cut. One example of that is Michelle Eisen, the lead organizer of Starbucks Workers United. Her efforts to create better conditions for hourly workers have brought unionization to more than 270 Starbucks stores and 7,000 people across the country. Just over a year earlier, the company had none. Carol and I asked Michelle about what's next when it comes to her fight for workers' rights.
And I do expect it to continue because the momentum really hasn't slowed. What we've seen is increased interest from Starbucks workers to unionize their stores because things are hard. Things are even harder now than they were, you know, a few years ago to be a service worker, to be anyone of the working class. And the reality of the situation is that the billionaires are not looking out for the working man. And so we need to join together and raise our voices and fight for what we believe is fair in our workplaces.
Starbucks, I think, to a certain extent, has always prided itself on providing a, at least publicly, a good place for people to work. So I'm curious, you know, what your experience has been, and also what specifically you and other union organizers and people who join the union are looking for from the company right now.
I think that you're correct. I think that's what has become so apparently disappointing to me in the last year, is that I came to this company back in 2010 because of who they prided themselves to be, because they were this progressive company that, you know, claimed to care about the environment and the community and most of all their workers. And I think that that was true when I started, but we've seen a very clear decline in how workers are treated within the company in the last few years. And the pandemic really shined a spotlight on just how they actually feel about us. We were called essential. Starbucks stayed open through the entirety of the pandemic. These are not remote jobs. We have to go in person in customer facing positions to perform these job duties. And they kept saying, you know, you're essential. You're essential to keep the world running. But we were continually treated like we were disposable. And we'd had enough. It was time to, you know, hold the company accountable. These are billion-dollar corporations. Billions of dollars are made off of the backs of the labor that is in the floor of these cafes every single day. And yet you've got workers who can't pay their rent. There's an imbalance there, and something needs to be done about it.
What do you make of the wider unionization drive that's taking place across the United States right now? And I should note, it is a far cry from what we saw, you know, at the peak of labor unions decades ago. But today we are seeing drives at places like Apple, REI, and more. What do you make of that?
Well, I think you're seeing, I mean, the wealth gap is significantly higher than it was even at the peak of the labor movement decades ago. So I think that's part of the catalyst. Certainly the pandemic and the fact that the working class was put in a position where their health and their family's health was at risk daily. If you were a service worker, if you were a worker in, you know, one of these shops that continued to stay open and provide what they were calling these essential services, and you had, you know, CEOs on these financial shows boasting not only about profits, but record-breaking profits in the middle of this pandemic. And workers are starting to question what their worth actually is. And there's a realization that, you know, we are the people who bring in these billions of dollars. If the working class just walked out of all of these businesses right now, these businesses would essentially cease to exist. And so I think you're starting to see people stand up and demand, you know, fair wages and at the very least safe working conditions, because these companies don't exist without us.
That's Michelle Eisen. She's the lead organizer of Starbucks Workers United, and she's part of this year's Bloomberg 50. Check out the full list online or on the Bloomberg Terminal. It'll be the cover story of next week's issue of the magazine. That wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Tim Stenovek. Coming up in our next hour, we're going to hear from the CEO of OpenTable on the restaurant industry's big comeback. And the CEO of Impossible Foods explains why reports of the death of the faux meat industry are greatly exaggerated. Plus, a new book goes inside the lucrative criminal enterprise of ransomware and details the band of so-called misfits out to stop it. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including a report from the magazine about how American Express got its mojo back. We'll also look at one of cybercriminals' favorite weapons, ransomware, and the loose network of tech nerds out to put a dent in the billion-dollar enterprise. Plus, a conversation with the OpenTable CEO Debbie Soo on a long-awaited resurgence for the restaurant business. First up this hour, we're talking food with another industry executive, Impossible Foods CEO Peter McGinnis. He recently joined my co-host Carol Masser from the Bloomberg Live Sustainable Business Summit, and they kicked off the conversation talking about what some see as a plateau in the plant-based food industry.
It's a very dynamic category industry with huge potential, and it's in its infancy. And I think people say, oh, the plant-based category, is it declining? Is the demise of it? It makes a great headline. It's a sensational story. And I would just say that it hasn't been established and created yet. So a big part of what I want to do at Impossible Foods is...
What do you mean by that? Because it has been established.
No, it's been around in earnest for, you know, probably less than 5 years.
Okay.
There's been vegan burgers and things out for 10 or 12 years. But in terms of alt protein that's going, you know, trying to displace the animal product, that's a 3 to 5 year phenomenon. And we just launched in retail 2 years ago in the middle of COVID. So if you discount, we've probably been available at retail for a year.
Yeah.
And so I think it's in its infancy. And I think it's yet to be created, yet to be established. And I think it's our job to really create this category. It's a $3 billion category in a $1.4 trillion addressable market. So it is very, very small, right? And it's our job to mold it and shape it and grow it. And that work hasn't been done yet.
Peter, you're someone who knows the food industry really well. You're reminding me you are 10 years at Chobani and you're doing this. You understand kind of reaching consumers and what they want. I want to go to a recent Bloomberg Opinion piece that talked about plant-based product sales in the U.S., and they said they've been flagging.
Sure.
The category's meteoric growth in 2020, flattening in 2021, and since last September, a key portion of its retail sales has dropped more than 10%. Its reputation has also been badly bruised by the stock performance of Beyond Meat, which is down more than 90% from a peak back in 2019. The column does go on to say, still, it's a mistake for investors to write off the value and potential of the sector as a whole, which will be a keystone among climate solutions going forward. So first up, I'm going to get to the climate solutions in a moment. The
Great.
First part, though, unpack it for me. What is, though, wrong with plant-based industry today and the sales? And then we can get into kind of the...
So the category is down, and that is a fact, right? You can read IRI data, Nielsen data. It was plus 40, 50, 60%. Now it's hovering at -5 to -7, depending on the week. And there's a lot of reasons for that. There was a COVID bump probably in there somewhere along the lines.
Yeah.
There was a novelty bump when it really, you know, first became available. So some of it's a correction, some of it's some noise in the data. And then some of it are, there are players in the category who will remain nameless because I'm a proponent of the category that are not doing well.
Okay.
And so, you know, the category is a composition of companies.
Right.
And so if there's some companies in a category that don't do well, they can bring the whole category down. And so we're doing well. I mean, we're growing 60% at retail. We're in 40,000.
Top line?
Top line.
Yeah.
Sales. And so we have our own playbook and we have our own, you know, approach here. I think it's lazy to look at comparables and try to project that on a category. Each company has their own issues and challenges and playbook, and some work, some don't work, but that doesn't mean that you should cloud the whole category, right? And I think the category also is confusing because some of the players in the category are old vegan burgers that are veggie burgers,
yeah.
And some of them are alt meat, which I don't like the name of that, but those are those products that are displacing
animal. Faux meat, never good.
Never good.
Do you want to eat faux meat?
No. Never good. And then look, I think the animal industry has done quite a good job. They're highly coordinated and pretty loud in trying to confuse this plant-based meat category.
Right.
With calling it processed or faux or, and they have a lot of money and they're highly coordinated, like I said. And I think where the mistake of the plant-based meat is, it's young, it's restless, it's very fragmented with a lot of different players. And we have not been coordinated in our messaging, and we have not been loud in support of our products. And so combination of big meat kind of being loud and coordinated and plant-based meat being shy and uncoordinated has not helped the situation.
So let's talk messaging. And let's get to the second part of that Bloomberg Opinion column, which said it's a mistake for investors to write off the value and potential of the sector as a whole, which will be a keystone among climate solutions going forward. So why is plant-based food a keystone among future climate solutions?
Yeah, it is the scale of food.
Because this would be great for the narrative.
Yes, it would be great for the narrative.
Or the reality.
And it's a complicated message to get out there from a consumer perspective. And I think a lot of the issue around, look, the food has now come a long way. So the food now stands up against the animal product. And most people that try it say it's much better than I thought, and taste, texture, flavor. And especially when you build a burger and you have cheese and, you know, put lettuce and tomato on it, it's very difficult, right? And we hear that with Whoppers, and we hear that with our Impossible Sausage Sandwich at Starbucks. So the food is in a really good place. We have not got the health credentials across, right? It's zero cholesterol meat, right? That has 30% less saturated fat and less calories. That has not been communicated. And then the climate piece of it, there is no other alternative to reverse climate change other than food.
Food systems account for a third of emissions.
Also, if you think about 50% of the usable Earth's land mass is animal agriculture related, and all of that land has been cleared. 50%. Yeah. 3% are towns and cities.
Yeah.
50% of the entire Earth's worth. So the scale is huge. And as a result, 60% of all wild animals have been killed. And animal products, and I don't want to sit here and go on and on about how bad the animal industry is.
We'll talk about your climate imprint when you guys do plant-based
meat. So our plant-based meat, if you look at 50 million pounds of our plant-based meat versus 50 million pounds of animal meat, right, direct comparison, we'll use 4.5 billion less gallons of water. We would save 37 million trees, and we would avoid 1.5 billion pounds of CO2. That's 50 million pounds. That's a small amount, right? That's a fraction of what we will make this year. So the scale is massive, right, when it comes to food. So food choice and climate change is a very, very powerful thing. It's misunderstood. Many people are not aware of it, right? They just don't equate food choice with climate change. So the more we can educate people, I think it can be quite powerful. And there is no other tool out there that has the power to reverse climate change like food choice, right?
But which is interesting because we focused so much on EVs, and I get the importance of it.
Which is, by the way, a good thing.
Right, right.
But if all cars went to electric, it would not have the impact of food choice.
So good business, and you and I talked about on the phone, I care, I turn over, I look at my food, I want to know what it is. My 19-year-old daughter does the same thing.
Sure.
Help me out, because part of the reason I'm not your customer, and I probably should be, because I care about my health, and I even brought it up in the newsroom and in our makeup room. I'm like, who's eating this stuff? And they're like, sodium. Like, you talk about the healthy part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can it be better?
It can be better. So one of the big things we want to do at Impossible, I think we have a really good product.
And I know you've done some reformulating.
Sure. We're on beef 2.5.
Okay.
We're not going to go iPhone
14. How far
14.
Do we go?
We're not going iPhone 14, but we're going to go probably beef 4.0.
Okay.
I can see probably a 3.0, a 3.5, and a 4.0 to perfect it. Taste, texture, flavor, nutrition. And every time we reformulate that food, and I think this is a big part of it, right?
Yeah.
We have to continuously improve those products. And these products have only been around 3 or 4 years. So it's not unusual to continue through technology and new ingredients to try to perfect the product. And in doing that, I think we'll chip away more at saturated fat, sodium, we'll simplify the ingredient list. The ingredient list is long, it's all plant-based, but it's long because you're trying to mimic the texture of animal meat. It's very hard to do.
It's complicated.
Very complicated. So people say it's processed. I think Twinkies are processed, right? It's artificial. It's not processed,
Peter,
because the ingredients...
Twinkies are processed.
Yes. but our food's not processed because the ingredient list is long. We're using a lot of different things to mimic the texture to get people to have it instead of the animal product. But it's all plant-based.
Right.
So I'd much rather ingest that than something highly artificial. Look, processed is food that doesn't contain a lot of minerals and vitamins and protein, right? Our food contains vitamins, minerals, and has more protein than the animal product. So it's nutrient dense, it's nutrient rich, and yes, the ingredient list is long, and we'll work on simplifying that. But these are all the misconceptions and myths out there that have been and affected people like you.
That's Impossible Food CEO Peter McGinnis with Carol Masser from the Bloomberg Live Sustainable Business Summit earlier this month. To hear and watch the entire conversation, head on over to BloombergLive.com. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, we stay in the food space and get some good news on the restaurant business at an all-important time of year.
We are continuing to see that that dining demand remains really strong. If you look at the year end, so for this entire year, we are approaching nationwide pre-pandemic levels.
OpenTable CEO Debbie Hsu joins us on the other side. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
In our last segment, we heard from the CEO of Impossible Foods on the health of the still nascent fake meat industry. Now let's zoom out for a look at America's restaurant business. This past week, Bloomberg News senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld and I had a chance to reconnect with Debbie Hsu. She's the CEO of the online restaurant reservation service OpenTable. And while she's based in San Francisco, Debbie says things are looking up for the entire sector from coast to coast.
We are continuing to see that that dining demand remains really strong. If you look at the year end, so for this entire year, we are approaching on nationwide pre-pandemic levels. We're up versus last year. So we can say that dining is back or that dining has held strong. The holiday season is looking great. Thanksgiving is usually a good, you know, a sign of what things are to come during the holiday season. And demand was really strong then. So people, we're just seeing that people are continuing to prioritize that dining out at a restaurant experience, despite all the news we're hearing and we're feeling it as well, right? Mm-hmm. About inflation, rising costs, all that economic turbulence. People are continuing to, you know, allocate pieces of their household P&L to the dining out experience.
How do you explain that? Because those things are at odds.
Yeah, I know. And I think, you know, we're still seeing some pent-up revenge dining, I think, as a result of the pandemic, when many of us were cooped up in our houses or apartments for a long time. So I think that is still playing here. I also think it's because for many of us, the nature of work has changed. Many people work remotely. Some people are in a hybrid situation where they go into the office, you know, twice a week as opposed to five times a week. Mm. And I think people are really craving that in-person, you know, experience that they're not getting when they're just working from home. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, dining out at a restaurant is one of those ways they can get that. And we're seeing that in the data too. We're seeing, for example, pre-pandemic days, bar seating was the least favorable type of seat that one could book. And right now we're seeing people are actually requesting those seats and wanting to be in the thick of it all.
No kidding.
So I think because work is changing for many of us, that has trickle-down effects, you know, into dining and our behavior as consumers, you know, what it means now to go out to a restaurant.
Debbie, let's unpack some of those trends. If the shifting nature of work is changing how people are dining out, what does that mean in terms of what days that people are coming to restaurants, what times, things of those natures?
Yes. So we're seeing that Mondays, to your point, are so historically Mondays were a very slow time for restaurants pre-pandemic. Right now, what we're seeing, Mondays are the weekend after party. It's kind of an extension of the weekend. So we're seeing really big increases in dining compared to last year, up 27% on Mondays. The time is also different in terms of the time that people are going to reservations. You had said 4:45 or 10. We're actually seeing a lot of people dining between 4 and 5. That time period increased 27%, a very large increase compared to pre-pandemic time. So happy hour is the new dinner.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because oftentimes, like if you are working remotely or hybrid, your commute, you don't have a commute time, right?
Oh, that's a good point. So
you could be done with work and you can shut down, you know, your computer and just literally, you know, leave your home and go to a restaurant.
Debbie, does that change? So I've talked about this a bit. I don't have any data on this, and I'm hoping you can help with this because it's all anecdotal for me. But in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, you know, I come into work every day because I can't work remotely. But if I'm off a day and I'm at home and I'm walking around the neighborhood, it is like packed. You know, sandwich shops that are usually packed on a weekday, on a weekend only, are packed during the week because people are working from home. Do you have any data that shows sort of the epicenter of these areas is kind of shifting a little bit because of people's work patterns?
Yeah, so we, and that the Brooklyn story or your experience is very similar to what we're seeing. You know, during the pandemic, I think a lot of people moved out of the city proper and in areas around a big city. Brooklyn here could be an example of that. And a lot of, so we're seeing a lot of dining activity happening, you know, in Brooklyn versus, you know, in the middle of Midtown or Manhattan. We're seeing that in the Bay Area here in San Francisco. So we're seeing like emergence of kind of these areas outside of cities really gain in prominence. And I think Brooklyn also, like it tends to have a younger demographic. If I were to guess, like a very cool demographic. So I'd like to you.
Tim's pretty young.
I don't know if I'm either of those things, but thank you, Debbie.
Young and cool.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
It's not surprising to hear that we have, you know, there's a big remote workforce out there that, you know, during lunchtime can go to the sandwich shop down the street.
So I've been thinking about what you said about people actually in some cases requesting to sit at the bar, because I've never done that in my life. But I don't want to sit at the bar. I don't want to sit next to people.
Okay.
That's what I mean.
Okay.
But in any case, are you seeing that in that sort of drive to be in the thick of it, in the action? Are you seeing that in the dining choices that people are making in terms of the types of restaurants that they're booking?
Absolutely. So we're seeing diners really crave that connectivity. So cuisines like Korean barbecue, hibachi grill, Brazilian steakhouse, those types of food venues are doing very, very well. Because again, unlike you, a lot of people want to be in the thick of it. They want to be sharing a table with folks they don't know and being in that kind of communal environment.
That's so interesting. Does this hold?
We're seeing it hold. It started up last year, and it's continued to persist this year. I really think a lot of it is related to the pandemic and kind of a new post-pandemic life with, again, work changing for so many of us.
Mm-hmm.
That right, like it impacts other facets of our life.
And so, I mean, if theoretically we're here a year from now talking about the trends that we saw in 2023, what do you think, what kind of conversation are we going to be having?
Well, I hope we're going to have a similar one in terms of dining demand remaining very strong. You know, and we watch the data very carefully across the board, just because there is so much noise regarding the economy, and we hear from restaurant partners how hard it is to be running their restaurants. But the hero of the day in the story is that consumers continue to prioritize going out and dining at restaurants.
Hey, Debbie.
So 30, I really hope, yeah.
Does that change, though, in a softening economy? I mean, everyone we've spoken to today is planning on a 2023 recession.
Yes. And we remain bullish about dining. We think that maybe the check size will change, but we think that people will continue to prioritize connecting with others, whether that be family or friends, at a meal at a restaurant.
That's Debbie Sue. She's the CEO of the restaurant booking platform Open Table. She spoke with me and Bloomberg News senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld. Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, the magazine team explores how credit card giant American Express was staring into the abyss at the onset of the COVID pandemic and has since come back stronger than ever.
Consumers haven't stopped spending. And if anything, Amex was like, you know what? We have this really good thing going. Let's double down.
instead of killing it, the pandemic actually gave it a glimpse into how irrelevant its brand could become if it didn't start spoiling cardholders who could no longer use a lot of the benefits that made it so famous, you know, its travel, its dining perks. So, you know, in that process, it revamped its platinum card. As you said, it upped the price, which was kind of a surprising thing too.
This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
You'll find our next story in the finance section of the latest edition of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. It's out now on newsstands, online, and on the terminal. Just over 2 years ago, American Express faced an existential crisis, losing customers and staring into a pandemic that hurt it more than others because of its focus on traveling and dining out. What Amex did next, according to our colleague Jenny Serrain, quote, maybe the marketing coup of the century. We get more from Bloomberg News finance team leader Sally Bakewell and the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber.
It wasn't looking so great for a second. And that is sort of what got me initially interested in the story. It was because it was like, oh, is there an existential moment here that Amex, you know, might not come out of the pandemic looking as good as it went in? People were suddenly not in the early days of the pandemic, weren't spending quite as much. They ended up doubling down and spending a lot more and have continued to spend. And, you know, the economy keeps chugging because of it. And that actually is part of what became this Amex story, because consumers haven't stopped spending. And if anything, Amex was like, you know what? We have this really good thing going. Let's double down and make it even more interesting. And that's basically what they did. They have an amazing loyalty program. They made it a little bit more expensive, and people just kept doing it. And what's incredible to me is, like, there are very few business models that can look like this. Mm-hmm. When other people come for it, you know, JP Morgan, Sapphire Card, once a Business Week cover story, they did a really amazing job of creating a business out of nothing. And yet Amex's moat seems like it keeps getting deeper and wider. So Jenny and Thomas Buckley did a great job telling this story. Sally Bakewell leads the finance team. Sally, what stands out to you about how Amex has doubled down and yet found new potential?
Yeah, I think the really surprising thing here is that instead of killing it, the pandemic actually gave it a glimpse into how irrelevant its brand could become if it didn't start spoiling cardholders who could no longer use a lot of the benefits that made it so famous, you know, its travel, its dining perks. So, you know, in that process, it revamped its platinum card. As you said, it upped the price, which was kind of a surprising thing too. It's now more expensive than the Chase Sapphire card at $695 a year. It added all these new
benefits.
That's
just to carry the sucker, basically. But go ahead.
Well, think of the Centurion card, which is 5,000. Okay. And of course, we all have one of those.
It's above my pay grade.
But I think that maybe I'm the only one who doesn't have one of those. You have to be invited to that. I've not been invited.
Even the CEO didn't initially get.
But Sally, this I'm thinking about like Amex going after, like they certainly had the establishment, I feel like, but going after younger folks, whether it's Gen Z, X, Y, whatever, millennials, like that to me seems to be a big part of this strategy, and it worked.
It really did. It was a huge part of the strategy. Amex said that it signed up more platinum cardholders this year than ever, and Gen Z and millennial customers made up about 60% of all of that consumer cardholder growth. But of course, with that maybe brings an added challenge, because this is an untested cohort of the population in an economic downturn. Now, Amex says they're not too worried about it because these people are keeping up with their bills, but they have already set aside hundreds of millions of dollars for potential soured loans. In fact, they did that in October and actually set aside more than analysts had expected. So they're very bullish, but at the same time, they're definitely shoring up for some kind of crisis.
Okay, so talk to us about the CEO, Steve Squeri, because for a long time, there was going to be a succession challenge at Amex, and boy, they found their guy.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he kind of came to the job, and he jokes that he was someone who never was expected to be CEO. Whether that's absolutely the case, we don't know. But he,
good story, though.
Yeah, indeed. Perhaps he just wasn't earmarked quite so clearly as the person who unfortunately passed away in a plane accident, and so it was Squeri who took over at that time. And I think, you know, he is credited with a lot of keeping Amex going through the pandemic. He sort of holed himself up. He says he took his daughters to lunch on a day in early March in the pandemic, saw how the city had emptied out. He sent all his employees home. He holed himself up and his key deputies up in his office, and they kind of figured out this plan, this strategy to revamp the card. And, you know, again, they might not quite have done it in the same way had the mm-hmm. pandemic not had happened, and they might therefore not have been able to regain the sort of cool that they did. You know, as you noted, they were kind of this credit card store. They were sort of more known for capturing the middle-aged customer, and they've gone really hard after the Gen Z, and they've been pretty successful. They now have a signature scent. The card is dropped in, you know, Jay-Z, Ariana Grande songs. They're
hip.
They're hip.
Cool. That's like real cred. Yep. Also, if you're the CEO, we talked about the Centurion card earlier. What is the Centurion card? And it turns out
if you have to ask, you can't afford it.
Well, I was like, you know, wait, you have to pay for a credit card? How does this work?
Right. So $5,000 a year, you can only get it by being invited to get it. And that's the kind of big joke from Squeri, is that he hadn't been asked to apply for the card when he took over. And, you know, it's extremely selective, and he had to beg, he said.
Okay.
Noel Gallagher has one.
I think, like, he could knows the right person to call to say, you know. Get me that card.
I also will just say that Warren Buffett has a little cameo in the story, talking about, you know, he has obviously an impressive portfolio of businesses. He could build any of them from scratch except for Amex, right? Like, you can't build Amex from scratch.
That was Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber and Bloomberg News finance team leader Sally Bakewell on a resurgent American Express. Now let's turn to a kind of payment that you don't want to be making. That is ransomware. According to a Bloomberg News story back in October, a senior White House official said the pace and sophistication of ransomware attacks is increasing faster than the nation's ability to keep up with disruption and recovery efforts. Thankfully, the U.S. government is not alone in trying to slow this pervasive form of cybercrime. Dan Golden is a senior editor at ProPublica and a former Bloomberg colleague. His new book, The Ransomware Hunting Team, A Band of Misfits' Improbable Crusade to Save the World from Cybercrime, shines a light on a ragtag group of computer experts trying to slow down the bad guys. Carol and I began by asking Dan about the impetus for writing the book.
What happened was we had done a piece, Renee, my co-author, and I had done a piece in ProPublica about a guy named Michael Gillespie, who was unknown to the world. He was had a tough life, poverty, cancer, didn't go to college. And yet he was the world's greatest breaker of ransomware codes, saving many, many people, hundreds of thousands at least, from paying hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in ransom. And then when we realized he was one member of this elite society, this group called the Ransomware Hunting Team, that was essentially the world's most effective force against ransomware, finding keys for victims so they didn't have to pay and yet not charging them a penny, we realized we had a great saga to tell.
All right, so tell us a little bit more, dig a little bit deeper and tell us about this group of individuals, who they are and, you know, what they are typically working on, because it sounds like we know we often report on ransomware cases kind of nonstop, and this has become a growing concern, growing problem, as Tim mentioned earlier. So take us a little deeper into the story.
Well, this is a group of about a dozen brilliant, largely self-taught tech and coding experts across seven countries in the U.S. And several European countries. And what they do is they crack ransomware code. So when ransomware is done properly, it can't be broken, and the victim either has to pay the ransom or have their systems disabled while they try and recover. But often the hackers make mistakes. They cut corners, they leave vulnerabilities, and the team is expert at finding these vulnerabilities. And when they do that, they can then uncover the key to unlock the files without paying the ransom. As you know, normally the hacker will demand millions or tens of millions of dollars and say, without that, you won't get the key. But the hunting team provides it for free.
More from our interview with ProPublica senior editor Dan Golden is straight ahead. He's going to explain the motivation for a tech-savvy volunteer group known as the Ransomware Hunters when we come back. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
More now from our conversation with Dan Golden. The ProPublica senior editor and one-time Bloomberg journalist has co-authored a new book called The Ransomware Hunting Team, a band of misfits' improbable crusade to save the world from cybercrime. It centers on a group of volunteer computer experts trying to slow down what the Treasury Department says has evolved into a billion-dollar internet racket. Carol and I were curious why they're so dedicated to a cause without a direct financial incentive.
They're very skilled at what they do. Their lives are on computer. Many of them have not met each other. They're very shy, retiring, ill at ease, but they're brilliant, selfless people.
What motivates them?
I think that they regard the internet as their world and computers as their world, and they want to protect it and protect people. Gillespie, our main character, the fellow in Illinois that I described, he has come from a law enforcement background. And when he was a kid, his parents used to take him to the Superman statue there in Metropolis, Illinois. And he grew up with this just desire to protect people, protect the internet. And I think then also it's kind of an intellectual challenge, the bantering back and forth, the tactical interplay with the hackers. They love that kind of, you know, cryptographic challenge.
How did they all kind of get together, if you will? How did they become this band of individuals pursuing cybersecurity and fighting against ransomware?
Well, one of them is named Lawrence Abrams. He lives on Long Island, and he's the founder and main spirit behind a site called Bleeping Computer, which is kind of like the salon of the ransomware movement, you know, the ransomware world. You know, everybody goes there. Victims, hackers, law enforcement, insurance companies, and his site predated ransomware. And when it started to become big, Lawrence recognized that it was a potential threat, and he had a lot of contacts in a lot of places, and he began organizing some of his friends and contacts to help fight it. And then now they take new members, you know, they have to have a unanimous vote, and if there's somebody they consider worthy, they'll bring that person in. But Lawrence was really the motivating spirit behind it.
What's so interesting to me is that this team is not law enforcement. Are the criminals two steps ahead of us, one step ahead of us? I mean, this has got to be something that concerns you.
Yeah, the criminals are always one step ahead. It's a bit of a whack-a-mole situation. And in fact, in a strange way, the hunting team, who, as you say, are just volunteers doing the best they can, in an odd way, they kind of contribute to ransomware getting better. Because what happens is this. Let's say a victim is attacked. They upload the files that have been disabled to the hunting team. It looks at them. It discovers a mistake in the coding. It finds the key. It gives it to the victim. That victim and other victims then don't pay the ransom. So the hackers then discover, oh, you know, no money is coming in. Somebody must have cracked our code. There must be a flaw. And they go through and they fix that vulnerability, and the ransomware gets even better. So, you know, the hunting team has had all these wonderful short-term successes, but in the long term, they're almost like a product tester for the hackers. And so the ransomware gangs, the quality of their ransomware keeps getting better and better. And also their tactics keep getting more and more ominous. They're attacking bigger targets, they're demanding more money, and they're getting increasingly dangerous.
That was Dan Golden. He's a senior editor at ProPublica and the co-author of a new book, The Ransomware Hunting Team, a band of misfits and probable crusade to save the world from cybercrime. It's out now. And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. For Carol Masser and Katie Greifeld, I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week. Monday through Friday, it starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News. And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find that at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bloomberg Business Week, available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal. You can also see us on Bloomberg Quick Take, available at Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone. This is Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.